Ian Bouvet works for the National Park Service, but he doesn't work at a park or exclusively in this nation.
I'm the National Park Service's Shared Beringian Heritage Program Manager. Yeah, so it's a program, so it isn't a park or a unit per se, that really celebrates and recognizes and promotes the shared resources, scientific and cultural and community-based, between, or rather on either side of the Bering Strait. So between Russia, really, and the United States.
The Heritage Program was started in 1991. Since then, it has funded research, held conferences, and pushed for the creation of a transboundary peace park, though in recent years it's been a little inactive. As program manager, Ian has his work cut out for him.
So how many people work for the Beringian Heritage Program right now?
One.
Just you?
Yes.
So, looking forward to the future, do you feel optimistic about the program and where it's headed, or are you feeling like, since you're kind of short-staffed, that it might be difficult to keep things going or start things up again that used to happen?
Oh, no, I'm very optimistic. You know, all of this stuff from the reactivating the Facebook page to the redoing the web page, if you hadn't noticed, is way outdated, to putting out a call for funding this year, and starting to plan the Beringia Days. It's all really exciting, and it's all still on schedule, and so far I've been able to handle it. You know, of course, it will be nice when we're able to get new staff in, but you know, this program has such a long history of support and a long history of successful projects that the future just looks bright.
Luckily, Ian's in good company. The movement to connect people across the Bering Strait has historically been one led not by groups or institutions, but by individuals. You're listening to Through the Ice Curtain, a Story 49 series where we take a look at the relationships between Alaskans and Russians in the last three decades. In the first two episodes of this series, we heard about attempts in the past to connect the two sides. But those efforts are ongoing. There are plenty of people from plenty of communities who are currently trying to reach across the border. In the rest of today's episode, we're going to hear about an example of a present-day reunification effort. Then, after listening to quite a few Alaskans, we'll finally hear a voice from the other side. I spoke with a woman from Sereniki in Chukotka, which is the most northeasterly province in Russia, and she shared her experience uniting with Americans. Part 1.
Hello, this is Lauren.
Hey, Lauren. This is Tandy Wallach.
Hi, thanks so much for calling.
Yeah, no problem.
Tandy Wallach owns an Arctic travel agency called Circumpolar Expeditions, along with her husband.
And my job is czarina of our company. I'm just being funny.
Circumpolar Expeditions brings people on adventure tours of Alaska and the Russian Far East. It was on one of these tours that Tandy's interest in Diomede began.
In 2008, I had a client who wanted to go to Little Diomede. And so I called up the tribal council over there to get permission. So I introduced myself over the phone, and I described a little bit about my company and what I did and why I wanted to come. And the tribal administrator, when she heard that my business took me over to Chukotka and I work with the native people over there, she said to me, Candy, do you think that you might be able to help us find our relatives over in Chukotka? And my first thought was, how could I say no to that kind of request? And so I said, sure, I know all those villages, and yes, I'll help you. And so that's how it started.
Big and Little Diomede are separated by 2.4 miles of water. Traditionally, they were occupied by members of the same families. But when the border closed in the 40s, the native people on Big Diomede were moved to mainland Russia. Big Diomede became a military base, and relatives on either side were prohibited from visiting each other. Now, Tandy is working to help them reunite. She submitted a grant proposal to the Shared Beringian Heritage Program, in fact. Tandy was awarded a 2-year grant to plan the reunion. But soon after, the Crimean crisis made contacting officials in Russia difficult.
Relations between the United States and Russia deteriorated, and it became very, very difficult to move anything forward. But that being said, that sort of simmered down, and we were able to, last year, finally was able to do a trip over to Chukotka, and we took a relative from Little Diomede over, and we went by whaleboat to all those villages looking for relatives, and we were able to find them.
The woman Tandy took with her was Etta Tall. Tandy and Etta met each other as if by fate.
I was in Nome. I was on a weather delay, taking some walrus scientists to Savunga, and I was waiting on the weather, and I was having coffee with Ted Mala at the airport pizza place, and in walks Etta, and he introduced me to her and said, you need to meet this lady because she's going to help you find your relatives. And she immediately took her hands and put them in front of her face and started to cry. And then I started to cry. And then I sat with her, and I think that was in 2014. And she sat with me and told me all about her grandfather's book and all that kind of thing. And so when I knew we were going to be able to go last year, I contacted her and asked her if she would go. And she was the perfect person to go.
Tandy was confident she would be able to locate some of Etta's relatives.
You know, I know people would say to me, how can you go over there? How are you going to find them? How are you going to find these people over there? And I go, I'm going to find them. And I know people doubted that I would find them. But, you know, the very first day, when we arrived off of the Bering flight in Providence, at the airport, we ran into people. And Etta was so wonderful because she had her grandfather's book that she carried with her. We had the family tree that I carried with me. And everywhere we went, we would talk about it.
After the success of last year's trip, Tandy planned something even bigger for this summer, a family reunion between Diomeders from both sides of the border. I called Tandy twice while she was planning this reunion, once in mid-March and once in late May. The first time I talked to her, she had just heard from the Chukotka governor's office. They said her dream location for the reunion wouldn't be an option.
I'm a dreamer, and I dream big, and what I wanted to do was be able to have the reunion on Big Diomede. So my research over the years about what happened with the relatives from Big Diomede, and I would talk to people about Big Diomede, and there was always this wonderful little stories about what they had heard about Big Diomede, that there were five villages over there. They understand that the greens are really better over there, that the walrus hunting is better over there. So there was always this longing to go to Big Diomede. So I got it in my head, then why not have a reunion on Big Diomede? So I've been talking that up for a year now to be able to do that for the reunion. Unfortunately, with my communication with the governor's office yesterday, they told me that would not be possible.
Still, Tandy was encouraged by the enthusiasm for the project expressed in their letter.
Because I was a little concerned that higher-up politics was going to have a trickle-down effect to us, and I'm just glad it's not the case. So.
The second time I called Tandy, she had just set a date for the reunion and found at least five Russians to cross over. But there was still much to be done.
We have to make arrangements for the charter flight, and that'll be Bering Air. We'll fly over to Pravodnaya and pick the relatives up after I've got them from their villages by boat to Pravodnaya with the proper paperwork. We're making arrangements for boats on Little Diomede and in Wales to be able to transport people from Wales to Little Diomede and back again. We are deciding what foods we need to purchase here in Anchorage, and then we have to ship them to Wales and Little Diomede so we have adequate food for the reunion. I have to arrange for sleeping accommodations in Nome, but that's not a big deal, but in Wales and Little Diomede. Because all my great plans, Lauren, I can make them out there, but the minute the weather happens and we're stuck somewhere, I've got to have food and accommodations and all that kind of a thing. So we're making alternate plans in case of weather delays. Another thing that we have to do is get international travel insurance for the five people coming from Chukotka. We have to arrange for Russian translators to transport them up to Little Diomede so that they'll be there so that relatives can talk to one another. And then
this is the kind of extensive planning that goes into a trip across the border. But now, just as in the 80s, travel across the Bering Strait is still possible due to the efforts of a few determined and creative individuals.
You know, most people think this is a logistical nightmare. It's a logistical challenge for me, but that's what I do. I have these challenges out there, and I just keep doing it. So,
something she doesn't have to plan for as much is what will happen when everyone gets there.
We're going to have 4 days of crying and laughing and dancing and singing and eating and sharing stories, just like any other family reunion. I'm hoping that this will open up a whole new broad range of cooperation between Alaska and Chukotka like we had before. That started with Jim Stemple's dream of a friendship flight. You know, there's a lot going on right now in the state because of the 150th year anniversary with Russia and Alaska.
She means the 150th anniversary of the Alaska Purchase.
And you know, the friendship flight is held up as this wonderful success that just opened the door for everything. And that was Jen, you know, that was his idea. He's a dreamer, and we need dreamers out there. And fortunately or unfortunately, I'm a dreamer too. And so that this dream is slowly coming together.
Of course, some travel the Bering Strait not just for short visits, but for something more permanent. That brings us to part two.
Luda is short for Ludmila. My real name is Ludmila, but it's hard to say for Americans, so I go by Luda.
Luda Kinnick lives in Nome, but she comes from the other side of the border.
I was born in a very small Siberian Yupik community at Sereniki, and the native name for it is Serenik. So it's about 500 people. I was born in actually USSR, during the USSR times, so about 40 years ago now. Actually, our village itself look pretty much like any standard village or town in all USSR, concrete buildings, apartments. So we had electricity and, you know, running water and stuff like that. But it is a native community, so people are relying still on subsistence life. So in that way, it's very similar to Alaska.
Luda's first interaction with Alaska was through the radio.
I mean, my uncle actually was a radio man. He had this little radio in his room, and he used to listen to KOTZ, KNOM, KSUY. You know, so I heard it a lot growing up, walking into his room, foreign language.
That wasn't all Luda heard of the U.S.
Of course, I heard about America as a country growing up in school, mostly, like, you know, in bad terms, because it was during the Cold War. So it was mostly negative comments.
Yeah,
so we were actually afraid of America and Alaska.
When Luda grew up, she became a traveling Protestant missionary. She also became curious about life in America.
Yeah, so as a Yupik, a Russian Yupik, we have visa-free travel for natives of Alaska and Russia, Siberia, Chukotka. So I came to gamble a couple of times using that visa-free status to visit my distant relatives and just to see how, you know, people live life there across, you know, the Bering Sea. I had to spend the night in Nome, I think back in 2004, and that's where I met people in KICY.
KICY is one of Nome's two radio stations, and it's affiliated with the Evangelical Covenant Church. Luda returned to Chukotka to continue her missionary work.
And then I got a phone call from KICY that they're looking for a person who would do the Russian programming. So I thought I'll come up. I didn't speak the language, you know, and I never touched the computer. I, you know, knew nothing about the radio. So I thought, well, I'll come up just for like 3 months, try it out, you know, and I'm stuck here. So
yeah. So was that a scary decision to make?
Well, you know, maybe I didn't fully realize back then, but it was actually much more scary to live in Russia as a young Christian.
I asked her why.
Well, it was post-USSR time, and we were brought up as atheists, as communists. So that mentality is still pretty fresh even now, in our days, in those communities. And predominantly, people are called themselves Orthodox, and I'm a Protestant, you know, so I experienced a lot of pressure from, you know, authorities and communities and Orthodox community. So, yeah, it was challenging.
So Luda joined the KICY team. At night, KICY switches to Russian language programming for their listeners in the Russian Far East. This is actually something that Luda had encountered as a child, listening to her uncle's radio.
I remember actually one moment when I was about 5 years old, playing with my dolls and in my uncle's room. And there was a radio station, you know, that he tuned into, and it was, you know, speaking the foreign language. And all of a sudden, it switched to Russian. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, I know how to speak English now then. So that was my first experience hearing KICY.
KICY was also meaningful to her as an adult.
And being missionary, I traveled to different communities and villages, and not having support there, I turned to radio a lot every night. So I listened to KICY practically every night, listening to their programming and music. It was a main source of my support. So I never even imagined that I would be, you know, actually a person who would be running that Russian program.
Luda first joined KICY in 2004. She used her 90-day visa-free travel, which she had to continually go back to Russia to renew. Later, she got a 5-year religious visa. But when that expired,
I decided to move back to Russia for good. Back in 2012, I think. And I lived there in my hometown for a couple of years, but I just had to come back. So I'm back ever since. So it's been like about 3 years now since I'm back here.
Like Luda mentioned, what initially brought her across the border was the prospect of visiting St. Lawrence Island to connect with fellow Yupik people and Yupik culture. As a child in Russia, Luda was not frequently exposed to her native language.
Yeah, my grandma barely used native language, only when she was upset with me. So I only know bad words in Yupik.
So something that really stood out from her visits was the Siberian Yupik language.
I was so astounded to hear my language. Like I said, I barely heard my language growing up. So it was so soothing to my soul to hear my language on a regular basis. And even though I knew little bits, but it surfaced right up front, you know, and I was able to pick up right away a few words. And it was just so touching to hear even youngsters to speak in Yupik as their first language. So that was my first impression.
She also noticed the difference in subsistence culture on the two sides.
In Russia, they do live off the land, as they call it here, subsistence life style, but they all hired by the government, by authorities to do this. So people can't just get up and do stuff like they're, you know, doing around here. So it's like a regular job on payroll. So you have to be staffed and give authority to do that. So it's hard to keep up the tradition that way. So when I came to Gambel-Savunga, I was amazed the freedom that people actually have to go out and hunt and keep their tradition going that way. So I felt like I was introduced to my own culture when I first came there. So I felt connected right away.
Here's where Luda's story starts to converge with Tandy's. On St. Lawrence Island, she also was part of a family reunion, albeit a more impromptu one.
And were you able to ever connect with relatives?
Oh, yes. So Siberian Yupiks, we have different clans. So that's how we know that we're related to each other, if we're part of a same clan. So I found a lot of people from my clan, which is Lakormit.
Yeah. And are you still connected with the people that you met there initially?
Oh, yes, definitely. They whenever they're traveling, they always stay at my place. I always have company from both Gambel and Savunga. And whenever they're here, they call up and we meet up and have a meal somewhere. So, yes, I still keep the connection going.
In the past 3 decades, so many events, projects, and ideas have brought Russians and Alaskans together. These reunions were inspired by historic connections between the regions and between families. But as Luda's experience shows, the reunification of the Bering Strait region is not all about trying to reclaim something that was lost. It's about the future. It's about forging new connections and keeping those connections going. New friends are made, new plans for the Arctic are dreamed up, and no matter what happens at the national stage, individual people have been, and will continue to be, the links that make the Bering Strait region strong.
Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly.
Thank you so much to all who made this episode possible. Special thanks to Ian Buvitt, Tandy Wallach, Luda Kinnock, and Sue Steinecker. Music in this episode was by Mystery Mammal, Kevin McLeod, and Dimension Bucket. If you or someone you know has a story to share, contact KNOM at 443-5221 or by email at story49@knom.org. Story 49, sharing your story, your voice, your Alaska. Yesterday.